This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 188 was recorded on October 10th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by Freelancer.com, the best place on the internet to hire freelancers for any job description. Variant Perceptions' Tian Yang is back with us as this week's feature interview guest. Tian says leading indicators clearly describe a significant growth slowdown, but not quite to the point of signaling a recession, at least not quite yet. Among other things, Tian describes in this interview why Variant Perception believes we presently have an excellent setup for a ratio call spread on the S&P 500. So be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when our own Patrick Serezna will review the ratio call spread strategy in detail. We'll also have a post-game guest, Amir Adnani, founder of Uranium Energy Corp. and Gold Mining Inc., who will weigh in on fundamentals in the uranium market.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500, after a big sell-off the other week, has really just muddled sideways. What's your thinking on the next move for the S&P here?
You know, it still feels to me like this market is, you know, despite the fact that it's fighting a mountain of bad news, it keeps looking for excuses to trade higher. It seems like lots and lots of things have beaten the market down for a day or two, but it always seems to bounce back. The only way that I can reconcile why that's happening is I think that there's widespread expectations that some kind of accommodative monetary policy concession from the Fed is coming. Now, we sort of kind of got the announcement of QE4 this week with a really strong dose of Jay Powell telling us this announcement of balance sheet expansion should not be confused with QE4. It's really not QE4, folks. Please trust me. It just looks like it, smells like it, feels like it, you know. Okay, whatever you say, Mr. Powell. It's not QE4. It just sounds like it is. Someday, Patrick, monetary accommodation won't be enough. And that's where we'll really be in trouble, when monetary accommodation from the Fed and other central banks doesn't support markets and they sell off anyway. And I predict that's the point where we see the next worse than 2008 size crisis. But hey, if I've got to, you know, grade myself on timing that call, I get a C+, and that's being generous, probably less than that. I thought this was overdue for years, and this monetary policy charade has kept markets propped up this long. Who says it can't go another round? So I'm on the sidelines and happy to be on the sidelines. I don't believe in the fundamentals for this market to go higher, but I think there's a very good chance that further accommodative monetary policy will take us higher, even as crazy as I think that is. Hey, we got Greece now with negative yielding sovereign debt from Greece of all places. So the world is a crazy place. Lots of crazy things can happen. At some point pretty soon, I think political uncertainty will be a factor. We don't know if Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or who might be the next president of the United States. I think that's got to start to upset markets at some point as we go through that uncertainty phase. So I think there's a lot of factors that could lead to either big upside or big downside in the market. I don't really have anything strong enough in terms of conviction to make me want to trade it.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index. And we see a little bit of a back, it's backing off anyway, off of its highs. You think that's it, a short-term high here, or do you think the dollar still can keep going?
Well, you know, everybody seems to be anxious to find a reason to say the top is in for the dollar. What I see is a healthy uptrend. And yes, we've moved off of the very top of that ascending price channel to almost approaching the bottom support line of that channel. But hey, that's what a price channel is. It moves up and down inside the channel. We haven't violated the channel support line yet. We've got still a little bit of room before we get there. So the next channel resistance test ought to come in right around 99 spot 75 to 100. Certainly that 100 is going to create round number resistance in addition to the channel resistance. I wouldn't be surprised if we have trouble getting through 100 and consolidate even further there. If we do get up past 99 spot 75, I'll be tempted to take some profits, expecting some kind of pullback and a better entry opportunity. But as far as where we stand right now, what I see is a healthy uptrend. You could argue that it's a buy signal because we're right just about at the bottom of that price channel. I'm not buying here just because I've had a big position on, and I'm sticking with it.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil. I want to sort of get your feeling as to whether you think that's a short-term bottom. And we retested those June and August lows and are bouncing. What's your take on oil, and how did the inventory numbers come in?
Well, let's start with EIA inventory. Crude oil building 2.9 million barrels, surprising some people. Cushing, Oklahoma, also building 941,000 barrels. That's particularly important because for a while we had a trend where Cushing was drawing down even in weeks that there were national builds. It looks like that trend has stopped. I was attributing that to those two new pipelines that opened up. It looks like the shock pressure that they've put on Cushing inventories is abating. Okay, so with those big crude oil builds, that would normally be a bearish signal. Why haven't we seen oil prices trade off? Well, everything that we saw in a build in crude oil was made up for by bigger drawdowns in finished products. Gasoline drawing down 1.2 million barrels, distillates drawing down 2.9 million barrels. So between gasoline and distillates, we got more than 5 million barrels of drawdown, offsetting just under 3 million barrels of build in crude oil. So net-net, it's a drawdown centered on finished products. The tape action has been really interesting to watch. For the last couple of days, for the first couple of days this week, it really felt like the bulls hit the ground running, trying to take the market higher. Then they all kind of gave up right around lunchtime and just went home for the day. And we sold off closing. It looked like we saw really brisk rallies that were going to take us to new closing prints above those key resistance levels. And we traded off during the course of the day and closed back below them. That changed, however, today on Thursday, as we got a nice rally into the afternoon, and particularly RBOB gasoline, which is often an early indicator of what the crudes are going to do, really took off to the upside. There has been a rally, and we did close at the high print of the day, or within a few cents of it, on WTI crude, and after the close, it still moved a few cents higher. But nothing compared to how rapidly RBOB gasoline has moved higher. So I think a bounce is on here. The most immediate target is going to be the 13-day moving average, which right now is at 54 spot 10, but that's going to come down to just about where the market is tomorrow. So the question is, you know, if we're done here, you could make an argument that we could be done here because the 13-day will be here, and that's the end of the short-term moving averages. It's possible that we'll get a reversal here. But based on the strength that I see in RBOB gasoline, I think we're going to keep moving higher. And the next cluster of targets would be in between $55 and $56. You've got everything from the 21-day moving average, 34-day moving average, 55, and finally the top of that range is right around 55 spot 95, where you've got the 100-day moving average. I don't know if we'll get all the way there. I think that's probably the optimistic case. The pessimistic case is we get a little bit above the 13 and see a reversal. But so far, it looks like gasoline wants to pull this market higher. U.S. production, Patrick, ticked up 200,000 barrels to 12.5 million barrels. That's a new all-time record. And remember, just a few months ago, when we broke through 12 million barrels, when that was a new all-time record, a lot of people were saying, okay, look, that's it. This is crazy. The top's got to be in because the rig count had started to come off. Well, now the rig count's not just starting to come off. It's been several months of the rig count moving consistently and persistently lower. Yet we still see U.S. production increasing. There's been enough time. There's always a lag time between the rig count and U.S. production. But what we're seeing now is that even after several months of declines of rig count, we're still moving to higher and higher highs. Some people think that this is because the completion of previously incomplete wells, what are called DUCs in the industry, drilled but uncompleted wells, they're getting completed. So even if you don't have the rig count drilling new wells, you're still bringing new wells online. Well, okay, that may be the explanation, but if the rig count continues to decline, eventually it has to have an impact on U.S. production. Does that mean that people are going to put more rigs to work and the rig count is going to recover? Or does it mean eventually U.S. production is going to top out? We'll see. For now, imports 6.2 million barrels, exports still strong, 3.4 million barrels of U.S. oil exported last week. So the market seems to want to rally here. It's tried a few times this week and fallen over and couldn't make it. Today was the first time that we saw a close above the key resistance levels that were holding the market back. Looks to me like maybe we've got some legs to this bounce, but we'll see what happens. I don't think we're headed much above 56. I would guess somewhere between 54.50 and 56 is where this is going to top out, but time will tell.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, which it looked like last week that gold was going to finally be able to get another little upswing started, and it's really just been pinned more or less around 1500 since last week. What's the next move for gold here?
Well, it's that same story that we've been seeing for several weeks. Every time a meaningful downside correction starts in gold, some geopolitical event seems to happen and ignites a rally, whether it's geopolitics or the Speaker of the House of Representatives announcing intentions to impeach the president, you know, China trade deals breaking down. There's always something that seems to lead to a very brisk gold rally. Now, remember, we're still at all-time record speculative long exposure in the commitment of traders reports. That is definitely a setup for a technical correction to the downside. Don't get me wrong, I'm extremely, extremely bullish on gold in the long term. But we do have a overbought situation in the commitment of traders reports. It's a setup for a downside correction. But every time we start to see one, Patrick, something happens. And I have been extremely impressed by gold's resilience here and its ability to hold on to these prices, even in the face of what really, I think, are some technical signs that we're overdue for a correction, just a correction, not a change in direction. That just further strengthens my long-term bullish conviction, but I'm sticking to my guns here. I still think a better entry price is coming. Maybe it's not going to be down to 1350 where the breakout zone was, but I still think we're going to see 1400, 1410 in there somewhere before this is over.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, which earlier in the week was flirting with the 1.50 level. And suddenly today we got a bit of a spike here. We're at 1.66. What's your take on the yield? Is that a short-term low?
Short term, it certainly seems like 1.50 is the new key resistance level. And as you say, we have seen a pretty vigorous bounce off of that level. But hold on, Patrick. We also saw the 30-year print an all-time record low yield of 2.17. That's not the 10-year. That's the 30-year. That's an all-time record low on the 30-year. And to me, Patrick, that's extremely indicative. It tells me that this rally in duration risk generally is still intact. We're seeing a bounce back on the 10-year. Potentially, that's a buying opportunity. I've already bought some. I'm long. I'm sticking to my longs. I'm not going to abandon them. Whether or not we've seen it top out in yield, bottom in price yet, I don't know. You've got plenty of room to see a deeper correction, and it would be entirely healthy. We've cut the yield on the 10-year in half in the last little more than a year. To see a backup in yields past 2% would not necessarily end what is, I think, a bull market in bonds moving toward lower yields. So I don't know how much we're going to get in terms of backing up of rates, but I think eventually we move lower.
All right. Thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's interview features Variant Perceptions' Tian Yang. Why did we invite Tian back this week?
Well, Patrick, Tian is a really solid macro analyst, and I love the Variant Perception guys in general. You can always count on them for a good chart deck, and they're very process-driven. They stick to their process, and they're driven very much by leading indicators. So they're not just, you know, talking up whatever story sounds good. They're driving their research based on solid analysis of indicators, and those indicators paint a certain picture for them. And I'm very anxious to get get an update from Tian on how that situation has evolved. Last time we talked to them, they said really no reason to think about a recession yet, weakening economic conditions, but not that bad. So are we at the point of predicting a recession? Are we not quite there yet? I'm really looking forward to finding out what Tian has to say about that. And in general, I'm looking forward just to getting this update because we haven't had Variant Perception on in close to a year. This episode of Macro Voices is made possible by Freelancer.com. Now, this is the place on the internet to hire a freelancer to do just about any job, from graphic design to website development, and literally 1,600 other skills. They do everything from graphic design for small businesses to enterprise-scale projects for big organizations that include NASA and many others. Freelancer.com gives you access to literally 38 million freelancers around the globe with every imaginable skill set. It's the best place on the internet to hire freelance talent. Now, I learned about Freelancer.com directly from its founder, Matt Berry, who also happens to hold the Farthest Traveled Award to attend a Macro Voices live event. And we plan to use them to do a complete overhaul on our own MacroVoices.com website. It's also a publicly traded company with great prospects listed on the Australian Stock Exchange under symbol FLN. So remember, when you need to hire a freelancer for any job, big or small, the place to go is always freelancer.com.
You know, Eric, actually, I remember Matt when we were out there in Vancouver. What a great guy.
Yeah, he came all the way from Sydney, Australia, just to go to Macro Voices Live. And he became a little bit of a celebrity because people were holding up their hands saying, you know, I came all the way from Wichita, and, you know, this guy came all the way from Sydney. So it was pretty clear that he had the Farthest Traveled Award. And I got to tell you, I'm very impressed with Freelancer.com. We are planning to use it to redo the Macro Voices website when we figure out what business model we're trying to establish as we get our sponsorship stuff straightened out. And I've been very impressed with what I've seen so far.
All right. Well, Eric's interview with Tian Young is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Tian Young, head of research for Variant Perception. As the Variant Perception guys always do for us, Tian has put together a fantastic slide deck to accompany today's interview. So I strongly recommend that you download it. Registered users will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the downloads next to Tian's picture. Tian, in past interviews, we've gone into depth on the process that you guys use at Variant Perception, and it's absolutely fascinating content. So for the benefit of any new listeners that may not be familiar with what you do at Variant Perception and the way that you use leading indicators and so forth to approach markets, I want to encourage them to go back to some of Jonathan Tepper's previous interviews on prior dates on Macro Voices, where we do this in detail. But for the benefit of anyone who hasn't already had the indoctrination, could you give us a quick review of the process that you use and how it flows into the current market environment?
Yeah, sure. So when we really talk about leading indicators, we're talking about leading indicators of the economy and for liquidity. So the way the world works is that markets are somewhat reflexive, so it's quite hard to mechanically predict it in a repeatable fashion. But the way economy works is that it's a lot more mechanical. So there's a certain sequence in which things have to occur. So, for example, building permits necessarily have to go up before construction activity can start and then before houses are built. Similarly, temp workers will generally be hired or fired first before the full-time workers. So by thinking about what's leading and what's lagging and focusing on the leading parts of the economy, we can have a repeatable way of figuring out what time. Now, once we see that, what we then need to do is actually make a judgment on how much of this is discounted in the market and where the greatest divergences are. And that's the part where it's a bit more art, just trying to figure out the greatest divergences. So the ideal scenarios are usually where, you know, things are priced very bullishly, but leading indicators are turning down, creating short opportunities or vice versa on the long side. So our entire process is about looking for leading indicators of the economy and of liquidity, where the greatest divergences are with the market, and then looking for trade ideas associated with that.
Well, this is, I think, the phrase that you used, that it's an art as opposed to a science, couldn't be more appropriate right now, because it's baffling to me. It seems to me that there have been economic signals for quite a while now that tell us that markets ought to be rolling over, but they're not, or at least they haven't in a decisive way yet. So where do you think we are? What are the indicators telling you as we get into page 3 in your slide deck here? Are we finally at the point where things are ready to give, or do we still need to wait a while?
So in terms of the growth trajectory of the U.S. economy, our leading indicators do show that the U.S. economy is slowing, but arguably this is quite consensus right now. And the key question really is about whether this is going to tip into recession or not. Obviously, we've seen the very poor ISM numbers come out for September and August, and clearly a lot of investors have been getting quite worried. As of right now, in terms of looking out to the next 3-6 months, I think our judgment is that it's more about growth slowdown with no imminent risk of a recession yet. The way we tend to think about it is that recessions are more regime shifts. The recessions are when you get positive feedback loops happening between kind of the real economy and the soft financial market data, where they create a negative feedback loop to cause markets to kind of really crash. So this is where, say, you know, credit spreads widen, and then in turn that feeds back into company earnings, and then company share prices fall, and then that hurts sentiment, and then credit spreads widen further. So it's these kind of feedback loops that once they start, it's quite hard to stop. As of right now, we don't quite see any of these feedback loops. We mainly just see lots of evidence of growth slowing, but not quite the kind of shift in tipping point, if you like, into recession. So as of right now, you know, stuff like fixed income is probably somewhat fairly priced, right? There's a slowdown coming, you know, that seems about right. However, for certain parts of the equity market, some of the more cyclical areas, for example, then there's more of a divergence where, you know, even if we don't tip into a recession, you know, it's highly doubtful if earnings growth can keep up the momentum they had over the past, you know, 3 or 4 years. So I think this is slightly more subtle right now, where it's a slowing. We're not quite there for a recession yet, but we need to kind of be on the lookout.
Now, I see on page 5, you're bringing China into the fray, and I couldn't agree with you more that China is so critical now. It's so hard to interpret where we really stand on this trade deal. So how do you guys see this, and how do you process? I mean, since you're so process-oriented, how does your process accommodate so many mixed signals coming out of the politics here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, clearly it doesn't really impact it directly, rather it's indirect. So when we look at leading indicators, there will be leading indicators of sentiment. And obviously for certain sentiment surveys, they will in turn tend to lead CapEx decisions or lead investment decisions. So that's kind of the way it would inadvertently feed in. And obviously the key way it would ultimately affect asset prices is that if trade war causes monetary policy loosening, which in turn will obviously help to drive another reflation cycle. As of right now, our China lead indicator is still actually quite negative, mainly weighed down by a lot of the external factors. As you mentioned, trade war is causing a big slowdown in global trade, and you can see it in the turnover of inventories. And if you look at PMI orders, for example, obviously for Chinese export orders, they've also slowed quite a bit. So there's a lot of external headwinds for China right now. And the PBOC have started easing a little bit, but it's not being meaningful enough to offset those negative external headwinds as of yet. So we kind of have a situation where the domestic data is kind of more like an L shape, kind of trying to stabilize a bit. But because we're being weighed down by the external, you know, we're still quite far from the kind of 2016 style reflation that everyone's kind of hoping for to bail us out. As of right now, it's looking, you know, like China's much more of a drag. And there's certainly parts of the international markets that are highly exposed to China that probably haven't really priced it in. So for example, you know, US semiconductor companies derive a lot of revenues from China. You know, if China's slowing and on top of that, there's a lot of trade war concerns, then, you know, those assets look quite vulnerable.
Tian, let's come back to this question of the art of translating these economic signals into market decisions, because it seems to me like the China story is bad to getting worse. But of course, if you understand the politics here, you'd kind of expect that. There's a game of chicken that's being played, and that game of chicken maybe at the end results in a deal coming together, and all of a sudden all these indicators change, and maybe that's the reason markets haven't reacted. So how do you bring the calculus of what really politically might be a game of chicken into what is otherwise a very mechanical process that you guys use for processing economic data?
Yeah, sure. So obviously in the short term, you know, it is possible we can get some kind of deal, and that will clearly be somewhat of a relief rally for markets. But it's quite hard to obviously know that without having inside information on how exactly the trade talks are going. But I think it's possible to kind of say a bit more about the kind of strategic implications and where we're going. You know, on the Chinese side, it looks a lot more like they are kind of entrenched for a drawn-out process. And it's very much about just trying to maintain the status quo for as long as possible. You know, President Xi has, you know, talked about how this is the long march, which is actually is a very loaded phrase in China. It's kind of, it refers back to kind of when the original Communist Party had to go on this long journey of survival during that kind of civil war. So there's a lot of very emotive imagery being used to prepare everyone for kind of a very drawn out process. And obviously with all the threats, you know, with Huawei and the supply chain, you can see that there's a lot going on to try and reduce their dependence on the US. So on the Chinese side, they're just trying to buy themselves more time. And if possible, you know, I'm sure they'll be keen to kind of just make a deal for the moment. On the US side, you know, as you mentioned, it's very interesting that, you know, President Trump is very much viewing it almost like a game of chicken. And obviously in game theory, when we talk about game of chicken, when, you know, you have two guys driving their cars at full speed towards each other, the question is kind of who blinks first. Unfortunately, it's actually quite hard to predict who will actually pull out first when they're kind of driving head on at each other. So actually that points more towards uncertainty. And arguably this is why nobody really knows. So the market's particularly sensitive to the news. So it could kind of tip either way. And that's probably why we're here. But certainly in terms of longer term implications, I think that there's a lot at stake here, right? This is more about the reversal of, you know, the past kind of, well, 50 years of globalization, you know, increasingly globalized supply chains. And as these kind of pull back, you know, as supply chains get routed around, the system will become less efficient and there'll just be less kind of profit opportunity. Arguably, you know, for US companies and Western companies, China's been very much seen as just a profit opportunity without all the kind of risks around it that's just kind of springing up. By the end of the day, if you invest in emerging markets, you know, you've got to be able to swallow the kind of the risk, the political risk and those kind of things that usually characterize EM investing. So I think it's just more investors waking up to what that really means when they invest in China.
Moving on to page 7 in your slide deck, you're shifting gears to Europe and the ECB. We've got less than a month now before Christine Lagarde takes over from Mario Draghi. How do you see the European situation and how do you assess the role that the European economic situation will have on the overall global market system?
So, I mean, Europe is quite interesting because this is the one part of the world where there's potentially a slight change in lead indicators. We can see our main European lead indicators starting to bottom out, mainly driven by the fact that monetary conditions in Europe are loosening. You know, European M1s have started accelerating, and typically that has actually led to economic surprises. So Draghi's, you know, really probably done as much as could be done on the monetary side now. I guess Lagarde, when she comes in, it's a question of how much she's going to push fiscal policy. But it does look like the coincident growth data in Europe is nearing kind of, you know, the peak pessimism. Everyone's obviously very focused on the German recession. But because the leading data and liquidity is improving, it does look like we're starting to near a bottom in Europe. So certainly in terms of the domestically exposed European plays, it's certainly getting a lot more interesting. But obviously, because our China lead indicator hasn't quite turned up yet, and obviously Europe's still very dependent on China through trade, overall, I would paint it as a case that Europe is stabilizing. So kind of the most beat up things have a potential to recover. But it's not necessarily the kind of V-shaped recovery that investors are hoping for.
Moving on to slide 8 in the deck, you're talking about some green shoots starting to appear in the global economy. Tell us more.
Yeah, so the green shoots really relate to global liquidity. Now, the thing to say about liquidity is that as a whole, the leads tend to be a bit longer. So it's important not to overreact and to watch kind of how it evolves. But because we've had a lot of central bank easing pretty much for the whole of this year, the impacts are starting to feed through into kind of leading indicators. So if you look at, you know, global excess liquidity, which is what we call real money growth minus economic growth, that started to turn up. And that's actually a very, very meaningful liquidity indicator that does actually provide a lead on a lot of risk assets. You know, there's a lot of ways of defining liquidity, right? So, you know, people look at, say, M2 to GDP and these kind of ratios. But in terms of what's leading, what we found is that looking at narrow money growth minus economic growth. And the idea here is that, you know, central banks and commercial banks collectively are creating a lot of money from thin air. And when that money is created, it can either go into the real economy as economic activity, or it just flows into asset markets and it goes to supporting asset prices. And so what we're seeing is that when you have a combination of money growth rising, but the economy is still kind of in the process of bottoming out, that actually creates a situation where asset prices end up accepting most of that extra liquidity. So that's what we're starting to see now come through in the data. So really, this is more about, say, by mid-2020 onwards, this is going to become quite a supportive factor. But in terms of for the next kind of 3 months, Q4, we're probably not going to see a huge benefit from the liquidity. The market's probably going to be a bit more focused on, recession risk growth, earnings growth for now. But, this, the green shoots are certainly helpful from kind of mid-2020 onwards.
And moving on to slide 9, let's talk about equities.
Yeah, so, obviously overall, I've painted a somewhat bearish picture, not outright too bearish, because obviously we don't necessarily see an imminent recession. But, as we've discussed, there's a lot of risks around right now. Earnings growth are being very poor. Yet, obviously, S&P is still trading somewhere near all-time highs, and equities have shown a very, very big divergence between some cyclical sectors that have been hit very hard. But for the most part, the index is holding up quite well. So, and against that picture, overall, we are still concerned by the fact that growth is slowing, by earnings slowing. So, we don't think it makes sense to be too fully allocated to equities. But we also recognize that the market is starting to be positioned that way. The BAML fund manager service came out. Obviously, people are very bearishly positioned. There's been a lot of surveys showing it. And even our own measures of how hedge funds are positioned, we can see that CTAs, macro funds are all very short right now. So this actually creates a somewhat binary situation where, if we can break out to all-time highs, it will probably actually, cause a lot of stop losses and actually generate a lot of momentum on the upside, when all the people that are under position get stopped out. Or the markets wake up and decide, we've had a few quarters of bad earnings and the guidance is very bad, in which case, the market is going to have to kind of price back down to kind of more realistic multiples. And so kind of against that situation, what is very interesting that you probably need more left and right tail trades. And so this is kind of what I've laid out over the next few slides as well, where in terms of right tail hedges, I think ratio core spreads are actually very, very interesting right now on something like the S&P. And the idea being that, if you sell like a core option that's say 105% of where spot is or somewhere, close above where the all-time high is, and then you can effectively use that premium to buy, two, three, or even four core options that's a bit further out of the money. So you kind of have this very leveraged upside if the markets really break through. But obviously, if we struggle to get above all-time highs, it kind of just expires worthless and you don't lose any money. So this is a kind of situation where we're thinking a lot more about the right and left tail hedges. On the left tail side, as I kind of mentioned briefly as well, we've seen semiconductors holding up very, very well, despite, the weakening in the fundamental data. Obviously, global semi sales have been very, very poor. Similarly, if we look at certain U.S. industrial companies, so, like the U.S. railways, they've recently started selling off. But for the most part, if we look at, car loads originated, these have been contracting for a long time. The railways are heavily dependent on the coal markets, and, we know coal's in secular decline. So, a lot of these companies where the earnings have been very, very weak, but their prices held up, this is where we're probably looking for more the downside plays, right? So these are where, you're looking at stuff like put spread collars and outright shorts to play for kind of the growth slowdown, and then kind of holding those right tail hedges on the kind of main indices, just in case we kind of break out to all-time highs.
Tian, as we talk about hedges and risks in the market, I'd like to bring up this question of what the heck happened with repo rates in the last few weeks. And for that matter, another event, which I'm not sure that it was related, but it feels to me like another ripple under the surface of markets, was the very sudden divergence between value and growth that we saw a couple of weeks earlier. You guys do a lot of work to really accurately map not just economic fundamentals, but also liquidity. So in terms of U.S. dollar shortage, the repo market shenanigans that have been going on, what do you make of this whole situation and how do you interpret it?
So I think our perspective on it is that even though the officially defined excess reserves are very plentiful in the system, because of various changes to regulations of how bank balance sheets are deployed, in practice, obviously, there's lack of reserves for the kind of main money center U.S. banks, the kind of too big to fail institutions that actually absorb a lot of the treasury issuance that's been coming out on the kind of intraday basis and on actually funding it. So I think from our perspective, our understanding of it is that originally, you have a situation where foreigners are going on strike in terms of buying U.S. treasuries. The main reason being that the cost of hedging into their own currencies is becoming very high. So before, you know, everyone might look at headlines and say, okay, you know, Japanese 10-year, 30-year bonds are yielding nothing. But in the U.S., you can get, you know, 1.5, 2%, depending on obviously what time they were looking at treasuries. So let's say, so, you know, in theory, they should buy U.S. treasuries. But obviously, if the cost of hedging is now 200, 300 basis points, then it doesn't make sense for them. And so you had foreign buyers starting to step back from the treasury market. So then domestic U.S. banks had to step in and slowly kind of disseminate it out. The problem with that is obviously that's tying up a lot of their balance sheets when they do it. So it seems more a regulatory issue where because the balance sheets are being tied up intraday, they really need to, you know, the Fed really needs to do something to address it so that you can lose some of the kind of reserves on their balance sheets to be used. I wouldn't term it as kind of the kind of, you know, worst case scenario of this is, you know, a genuine banking crisis or, you know, there's really a lot of the plumbing's kind of showing a lot of systemic risk. This seems more the case that the systemic important banks don't have enough reserves to fulfill their various obligations under all the new kind of regulations that come out. So this is something the Fed can address. And obviously the Fed, by going into the market and, you know, doing open market operations, can address it. They can obviously open discount windows. So this is probably more just saying that there's a lot of unintended consequences from regulation. But I think from our perspective, we don't view it as like, you know, the kind of money market stresses that led into the last crisis where there was it showed that there's a lot of problems within the underlying economy.
Another prediction that we've heard from some of our guests on Macro Voices is that before Q4 is out, the Fed will announce QE4, another round of quantitative easing. And if that were to happen, some people are saying, okay, look, the history shows us every time the Fed announces another round of QE, markets just rip higher. Other people have said, no, wait a minute, the dynamics are changing. The efficacy of QE each time it was done was less than the time before. We've kind of reached the point where QE has run out of steam. It's not really going to be enough to rescue the markets this time. It wouldn't work if they did it again. You guys look at liquidity very objectively. Do you have any opinion on which side of that argument is right? And for that matter, what is your take on whether or not there is any real likelihood of the Fed announcing QE4, either in Q4 or any other time?
Yeah, so in terms of our liquidity framework, as I mentioned, we tend to look at kind of real narrow money growth a lot. So when the Fed does QE, obviously it's mainly about them growing their own balance sheet and then putting money out there. But it's not clear that if there's a multiplier effect on top of that, right? You still need commercial banks to be responsive to go and create the money to really get money growth as a whole to rise. So as of right now, if you look at Fed lending surveys in terms of loan demand and the like, there's actually not a huge amount of demand. So, you know, I think it's fair to definitely say that the efficacy is going to be lower in terms of just the impact on money growth. But clearly at the margin will still be beneficial, right? It's going to squeeze everybody further up the risk curve. So the old kind of QE reflation playbook, long equity, long bonds, you know, it should still be valid as long as the Fed's doing something. It's just a question of how much. I don't think it's going to stop working because obviously ultimately you're mechanically still creating extra money from thin air. And we just live in a system where central bank and commercial banks are driving liquidity conditions. So from that perspective, you know, we're probably somewhere in the middle. I do think it will work if they do announce it in terms of asset prices, right? For the economy, obviously we've seen over time, it doesn't really work. But in terms of boosting assets, you would think it's still going to be something that works. But in terms of when they announce it, it seems quite optimistic. I would guess all the people calling for QE in Q4 is because they see an imminent recession, presumably because, you know, yield curves have inverted and ISM, you know, has dropped below 50. But as I kind of discussed earlier in the presentation, you know, we think of recession as a regime shift. So you need to kind of look across all areas of the economy to see if you're getting feedback loops kicking in. And as of right now, there's very few feedback loops. You know, truck sales might be slowly rolling over, right? Building permits are not growing the same pace, but, you know, credit spreads obviously very tight. You know, initial claims haven't really ticked up too much. So you don't quite see, you know, the signs of simultaneous deterioration in both the hard and soft data that would suggest we're heading into imminent recession. And, you know, before we hit a recession, it seems doubtful that the Fed will go.
Tian, I just want to come back to the point about value and growth, that divergence where we had one day where all of a sudden there was just this cataclysmic shift, even though the market index overall didn't move that much. So most people didn't even notice it. But there was a huge ripple under the surface. Was that horribly significant or was it not a big deal?
I mean, just judging by the price action, you know, if you get large one-day moves that don't follow through, it's probably, you know, somewhere that quant funds got overstretched and it was kind of a stopping out kind of process. I guess from our framework, what we can say about growth value is obviously it's implicitly a judgment on where rates are going. Obviously, if interest rates are going lower and discount rates are going lower, it tends to benefit the growth stocks more than the value stocks, just because now your future cash flows, you know, discounted to today are worth a lot more. So I think this is more about implicitly markets saying that rates are probably not going to go much higher. What is very interesting, though, is if you actually look at growth, the growth value differential and plot it against ISM, the ISM actually does provide a lead on it. And obviously, the ISM can be used as just a proxy for growth generally. So potentially, given that the ISM is continuing to trend lower, it's actually at the point where it's saying, you know what, growth stocks might be a bit too overpriced. That yes, you know, the reason it, you know, growth value is here is because of where rates are. But because the underlying growth conditions are deteriorating, there will probably need to be adjustment here, where if the earnings continue to be very poor, then the growth value relationship should actually come in a little bit. So I think that's probably where we are. It's kind of really, we're coming to the crunch point. And obviously, we're going to see Q3 data, the Q4 from all our lead indicators suggest that as a whole, earnings are going to still be very poor. So, you know, we've got another good 3 to 6 months worth of earnings that are not going to be great. So that'll be very, very interesting to see if the growth value persists. But, you know, if the ISM relationship holds, then it suggests that does need to compress a little bit.
So far, we've been focusing on developed markets. Let's move on to emerging markets. What do you see on the horizon there?
So again, when we think about EM as a whole, in terms of top level framework, we really care about liquidity. We view EM as very much a higher beta play on whether overall liquidity conditions in the world are rising or falling. And so there's kind of two key things we think about for EM. One is global liquidity rising or falling. So as I mentioned, you know, we see that from mid-2020 onwards, it's going to start looking a lot better. And then the second key thing we want to see is that EM liquidity is rising faster than DM. And the reason this is important is because normally when developed markets create liquidity, it will tend to flow to where the yield is highest. So typically, say, emerging markets or higher risk assets. And what's interesting is that when that money flows into emerging markets and emerging economies, it actually causes a buildup of FX reserves a lot of the time, which allows those EM central banks to in turn loosen monetary policy and so create this kind of second monetary easing on top of the first kind of initial capital inflows. So that's kind of the recipe to really drive like a big reflation wave in EM. So that we haven't quite seen yet. So for now, our view is that it still makes sense to focus on DM in terms of, say, equities. But obviously on the fixed income side, EM fixed income is actually still somewhat attractive. A lot of EM central banks are going to be following the Fed, following the ECB and easing policy. But obviously their rates are much higher, so they have a lot more room to cut. So there will be a lot of support there for EM fixed income still. I mean, EM fixed income has had a very good run this year. But if we look at where, you know, treasuries are and where they're yielding, you know, there's still a lot of room, I think, for EM rates to come down. And, you know, if you even look within the US neighbors, right, Mexico's just started their easing cycle. They've hiked rates, you know, some 500 basis points during this cycle, right? So there's a lot of room for them to cut still. So I think EM fixed income is still very interesting right now. But EM equities, I think you want to wait for, you know, very, very clear evidence of a major recovery in liquidity before turning overweight there.
Tian, I'm just thinking back to the comments you made earlier about the ratio call spread. I believe that you said you were actually looking at several different tail hedges, both right tail and left tail. And I think it's so relevant because, frankly, we've had quite a few guests on Macro Voices recently with extreme views in both directions. There are a lot of people making good arguments for why the Fed could step in with QE4 and that could cause stocks to rip 1,000 points higher. We've got people talking about why the crash is just around the corner. And frankly, nobody's really sure. So do you have any other tail hedges, either right or left tails, that you guys are looking at and discussing with your clients that you might be able to share with our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So I think something, you know, I've been thinking a lot about is in Europe, because obviously what we had is Draghi come out and say, effectively say we're going to do QE infinity until, you know, inflation gets back towards target. And so, you know, potentially Europe's already there in terms of this play where if the QE kicks in, and now they've obviously stopped, they've actually introduced tiering in the banking system. So it's going to be, you know, less painful for the banks that something could happen in Europe. And this is particularly interesting because obviously Eurozone banks are still depression kind of levels, right? We're like back to the, I think we're even below the lows hit during the initial 2012 kind of Eurozone crisis. And so you end up with a situation where the banks, bank equity themselves almost traded like their options. And so so if you actually look to buy call options on the Eurozone banks, they're insanely expensive right now. Now, what's very interesting is that for the Euro stocks index as a whole, so the European wide index as a whole, call options actually not as expensive in relative terms. So what you can potentially do is set up a call switch where you sell Euro stocks banks calls to fund index calls. And there the ratio can be very extreme, you know, potentially even 10 to, you can buy 10 call options on Euro stocks just for selling one bank call. Now, obviously, the reason for this is that there's so much focus on the banks, you know, potentially they could outperform. But even if we go back to, say, you know, when the last QE happened, 2015, 16, I think the beta, the highest the beta really got for the banks was around 2. So say if the banks rally 50% from here, you would think the index should probably still be up about 20, 30%. So obviously, if you just strike your calls appropriately, you know, that structure should really pay off a lot. So there, again, it's just taking advantage of the fact that vol's incredibly expensive on the banks themselves and use that to buy wider index kind of options. And obviously, the idea being that banks are an essential part of the European economy. If the banks truly recover and they could truly start lending, then clearly the wider economy and the indices should also do well as well. The only kind of risk around is, obviously, if you get a situation where the banks rally a lot, but the European indices doesn't. And as far as I can think of, those are probably only going to happen if, say, the ECB starts doing QE by buying bank equities or something that can really cause the kind of banks to massively, massively outperform the index. So, you know, that's the example of a right tail hedge. I think it's quite attractive to at least keep an eye on or to think about. In terms of left tail hedges, you know, similar to kind of the semiconductor example I gave earlier, I think it's very much looking at sectors of the economy that people think of as, you know, very high quality as bond-like, but that are actually somewhat cyclical. So, you know, I mentioned kind of railways and semis a bit earlier where, you know, people think these are great quality businesses, you know, they have a lot of, you know, monopoly, oligopoly power, you know, essential products, but ultimately it's still cyclical. And I think there's a lot of businesses that fit into that where, you know, if you set up downside structures on those names themselves, it could be very interesting, right? One example I can think of, say like Facebook, right? Everyone thinks of it as obviously its growth, its tech, you know, it's a monopoly, you know, social networks, but ultimately they depend a lot on advertising revenue. In a recession, advertising revenue is going to drop. Facebook probably has a lot of exposure to the more startup type companies that, again, in a recession, are probably just going to, you know, go into bankruptcy. So there is, again, it's probably somewhat asymmetric where in a recession, those companies that people previously thought of as very high quality companies are going to get hit. So that's the kind of left tail hedges I would be thinking of.
Well, Tian, I can't thank you enough for another fantastic interview. Before I let you go, for any of our listeners who are not already familiar with what you do at Variant Perception, please give us the quick rundown on what you do there and how people can follow your work.
Yeah, sure. So Variant Perception is an independent research provider, which focuses on using leading indicators to come up with investment strategies. So obviously, a lot of stuff we talked about today is grounded in leading indicators and then trying to translate that into trade ideas. We also offer clients a data service where they can subscribe to receive our proprietary lead indicators or our proprietary scores. So for kind of institutional investors who are interested in either the data or the institutional research, please look up variantperception.com for more information.
Well, Tian, I really appreciate another terrific interview. We look forward to getting you back in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it's always great to have an update from the Variant Perception team. What did you take away from your interview with them?
I was particularly interested. I had forgotten, frankly, about the ratio call spread strategy, and I think Tiana is right. It's a very good call here because one of two things is going to happen. This market's going to tank or it's going to crank higher on QE, and I think it's an ideal setup for that strategy. Now, I know that in your options course, you go into gory detail on how to put that trade on. You also did a boot camp video on the ratio call spread. Can people get that for free if they sign up for the free trial at Big Picture Trading, or do you only get that if you sign up for the options course?
You get that for free. So we did that boot camp for Macro Voice listeners. I can't believe it's been more than a year. I think it was in early 2018 when we originally discussing it. But we did do a boot camp. It is in our member section for free. And so anyone who subscribes to a free trial to the site can get access to it.
Okay, so for anyone who's not familiar with this strategy, the idea is if you think the setup is the market's either going to move lower and you don't want to lose any money betting on the upside, but you think if it does go higher, it's probably going to go a lot higher because what's going to take it higher would be some accommodative announcement like an even more vigorous QE4 than the muted QE4 announcement that we had this week. That's where this strategy comes into play. So I agree with Tian. I'll tell you what, Patrick, let's do a quick refresher on it during our post game. But first, I want to go to our post game guest, Amir Adnani, who is founder of Uranium Energy Corp and Gold Mining Inc. So let's bring Amir in because I want to ask him about the uranium market. Amir, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Amir, I wanted to start off by picking your brain on how things are developing in this uranium space. I think it's fair to say that we've been in this prolonged bear market in uranium for at least the last half decade with this oversupply pushing uranium prices to levels where it's completely uneconomical for many miners, like for instance, Cameco shutting down the MacArthur River. Are we finally seeing conditions where the excess supply will deplete and these prices will begin to recover? What's your take on what's happened and how things are progressing?
Yeah, just for a bit of context for everyone listening, one of the unique characteristics of the uranium market is how the buyers of uranium, the utility companies that use uranium to generate electricity, they typically like to buy uranium under long-term contracts. And we're talking very long-term. Some of these contracts could be as much as 10 years. And so the contracts that were signed 5 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago at higher prices kept some of the producers continuing to produce uranium at these levels and frankly oversupplied the market. So one of the reasons why we did end up with an oversupplied market. And as these contracts start to roll off and expire, and then those producers are faced staring at this low uranium price of $25 per pound. And here they were all these years getting uranium at $45, $50 per pound under those long-term contracts, they're having to shut in production to help rebalance the market from being an oversupplied market to hopefully ultimately a supply deficit. So why we are fundamentally at an important point in the market today is that many of those long-term contracts, majority of them have either expired or are expiring this year, next year. We are at the beginning of another major contracting cycle, but contracts cannot be signed at these very low uranium prices, where the uranium price is well below the marginal cost of production for most producers in the world. That's typically a setup for we've hit the bottom for any commodity. And now you see, like you mentioned, big producers shut down big mines. These are typically really important indicators that a commodity price is really bottoming. It's difficult to predict the exact timing of things will turn around. But ultimately, I think that's what underpins the fundamental shift that we see in the market right now.
All right. And so what advice could you give our listeners when they're looking to invest into the uranium and uranium producing market?
The uranium market and mining uranium is one of the most highly regulated industries, more regulated than gold and copper mining, and equally regulated as what it takes to build a nuclear power plant. I mean, I can tell you from personal experience, I've been directly involved with permitting 3 different mines in the United States for uranium mines. And these can take anywhere from 5 to 7 years. I think one of the key areas to look at are whether projects that can be developed into a potential future uranium mine, whether they're permitted or not. I think that's such an important distinguishing feature of successful development in the uranium business, is the ability to get permits, to get the necessary licenses to mine uranium. It's a very license intensive business. And so you may have a lot of uranium in the ground, but again, if you're not in a jurisdiction, a country, a state, a province that has the necessary regulatory framework in place to be able to issue permits in a timely fashion, then I think that becomes an issue. So that could be advice. And, you know, the other advice could be, frankly, patience, because uranium is definitely a nuclear industry. These are somewhat slow moving sectors. And so the fundamentals may start to shape up, and we may be, and certainly are, at a positive turning point and a shift, as I mentioned, in the sector from a supply demand point of view. This year is the first year in a long time that the demand for uranium at 190 million pounds per year outstrips what is projected to be production of uranium at about 140 million pounds per year. So that's a really nice setup, but that doesn't mean that that you can expect to see a sharp increase in uranium prices immediately. But when it does start to move, the moves could be exciting. I mean, in 2006, you had the uranium price at roughly $20 per pound, similar setup as we have right now. And by summer of 2007, the price was as high as $140 per pound. So you also have the fact that once utilities really begin to contract, and you must remember these nuclear power plants are big, multi-billion dollar operations. And so the uranium is a very small percentage of their cost to operate. And when they need to have it, they must have it. There isn't a substitute for it. It's a small portion of the costs. And so, again, all of those are, you know, points to keep in mind as if you're looking at investing in the sector.
Now, Mir, I wanted to move on and talk about gold. Now, what's your thinking here? Has this big breakout in gold that we've seen, is this the beginning of a new bull market? Is that finally that turning point here?
It really depends on what your expectation is or what your thinking is around the forces that could be driving the gold price. I think for a long time, there's been a singular thinking around what drives the gold price, and it's the relationship it has to the U.S. dollar and the inverse relationship it has to the U.S. dollar and also the 10-year treasury. I think while that is true, we're in an environment right now where we may end up seeing a rising U.S. dollar along the side of a rising gold price. And that really, I think, speaks to the fact that with the incredibly, and this is hard for me to understand, but this incredible phenomena, which is growing, it seems, at a monthly basis of negative interest rates. And people sometimes say, oh, well, negative interest rates have always been around. Japan's always had them. But we've never had it in the size, order, and magnitude that exists today, close to $17 or $18 trillion of negative yielding interest rate throughout the world and the developed world, places like Germany that has gone entirely negative now. This is an environment that I think suggests the groundwork is laid quite sufficiently for stronger gold prices for a long period to come, and rising gold prices along the side of strong-ish U.S. dollar. Now, having said that, just about every central bank on the planet, including our own Fed, is going to be easing. And so for the Fed, it's going to be, I think, very difficult. And for the U.S. economy, it's going to be very difficult to have a very strong U.S. dollar when, you know, every other currency is heading south and easing is taking place just about everywhere. So it seems like for fiat currencies, it's a race to the bottom, and it's a race for every major central bank to try to basically devalue almost this currency in this environment. And the record level of negative yielding interest rate, gold should be the winning place and a safe place, and a place not only to preserve and protect wealth, but to also create new wealth. You've seen big banks like Citigroup come out and project $2,000 gold price in the next 6 to 12 months. And it's not some, you know, the CNBC commentators would typically be calling gold the barbaric relic or whatever they call it. That's no longer the case. And I think you're seeing that consensus start to develop as why it's almost imperative to be exposed to gold, holding gold, physical equities, whatever the form is. And I feel very confident in that.
Now, you're going to be joining me at the Silver and Gold Summit as well, with speakers like Rick Rule and Maren Katusa are all going to be out there. Now, the Silver and Gold Summit is at the end of the month. What are you going to be speaking about or discussing during the show there?
One of the topics I'm going to be talking about, and I'll be talking about what I typically characterize as the two yellow metals. And so it's gold and uranium are the two yellow metals. And, you know, we just touched base on both of those. But I'm very intrigued, have been for many years now, with the royalty business model. It's been a phenomenal way for precious metal focused royalty and streaming companies that basically advance capital to a developing or up and coming producer to in exchange for a future royalty on that commodity that they're going to mine, and build a business around that. Companies like Franco-Nevada have become significant sort of multi-billion dollar players in the gold space. And I'm very interested to implement this business model in the uranium space. So I'll be talking about a company called Uranium Royalty that I'm the chairman of, and this company's business plan on how to kind of implement the royalty model in the uranium sector. And I'll also be talking about what President Trump has been doing in terms of looking at and mandating that a White House nuclear fuel working group be created, because there's a national security issue around the shortage of uranium in the U.S. U.S. is importing practically all of its uranium requirements from foreign sources, mainly Russia. And this is something that has geopolitical implications. And there might be definitely news and developments around it as well by the time we get to San Francisco. So want to talk about things that are pressing and sort of around us, and I think people are going to want to hear about. And so those would be just a couple of topics that I'll be touching base on.
Well, that's great. And can you please share with our listeners where they can learn more about you and your companies?
www.uraniumenergy.com and www.goldmining.com.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you in a couple weeks out at the show.
Looking forward to it as well.
Thank you.
Patrick, before we wrap things up today, I want to make sure we get back to this ratio call spread idea. Let's do a quick review of the concept for our listeners. And again, folks, if you want to get the much more in-depth video on the subject, just sign up for a free trial of Big Picture Trading. You can find that at bigpicturetrading.com. For the benefit of today's discussion, Patrick put a slide deck together with a number of charts that relate directly to the trade recommendation that Tian talked about in today's feature interview. You'll find the post-game chart book download linked in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered and don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Tian Yang's picture. Patrick, let's dive into this. On page 2 here, you're talking about the traditional ratio call spread, which is a 2-to-1 ratio. Tell us about it.
Well, the traditional ratio call spread involves you selling a call option and then choosing two higher strike call options and subsequently buying them with the same expiration. And so you're using the premium from the short call to pay for the premium of the two farther out of the money strike call options on the upside. And by matching the same expiration, then it has the same margining or carry cost characteristics of a credit spread. And often you're able to open these trades almost very close to a near zero cost. And so this ratio spread is really interesting. But what I found fascinating about where Tian was going with is that they were talking about ratioing these calls even 3-to-1, 4-to-1, or in the case of when they were talking about European banks and the Euro stock, 10-to-1 even. And I thought that was really interesting. So this it's a topic that I'm looking forward to discussing further.
Okay, so just to keep this simple for our listeners, the upshot of it is you put a trade on which costs you nothing in the sense of premium. It's exposing you to risk that if the stock market goes up a little bit, then you could end up losing something on this trade. But if it goes up a lot, you essentially get a free call option. How could you get something for free? Explain how this works, Patrick.
Well, there are different risks. And so I wouldn't want to say it's for free. You've just put on a trade that has a different risk profile. And this is where on the slide deck on pages 3 and 4, it shows two key characteristics. First of all, what we can identify is when comparing just a straight out call option, which is a debit and it costs you money to open, the slope of the call option and the rate of which you start making money, if you're proven right, it accelerates quicker, but it comes at a cost. And you're dealing with all sorts of issues like time decay if it's not moving in your favor. The ratio call spread has a slower acceleration to the upside because you're contending with that short call against your two long calls. But what I wanted to really focus on page 4, where it shows the ratio call spread at expiration. And this really is where the key risk transfer occurs, where the call option, if you're at the money strike price or lower, the call option will expire for a full loss and it costs you a debit. And so in a situation where you actually believe the stock market could go higher, but it didn't, you're going to lose money. What's really fascinating about the way that Tian explained it was that it's a way to hedge right tail risk. And I thought that was really well put, because what you're looking for with a ratio call spread is something that costs you very little. And if the stock market stays the same or even goes down, there was almost no cost to carry it. But if the market really rips higher, you have something that is going to give you upside exposure. And so on this chart 4, you can see what happens is your maximum risk of loss is if the market goes up, but doesn't go up a lot. Rather than for a pure call option, your risk is that it doesn't move or goes down, and that's where you lose your entire premium. And so it just changes the way that you're expressing the upside. And when you have a theme, like often, you know, you've in your market wraps have often even suggested it, that if the market was to rip higher, it will probably catch everyone off guard and make a big move higher. And this is why that ratio call spread is an interesting way of putting on that right tail hedge, just in case that's going to play out that way.
And it doesn't cost you anything if the market goes lower, whereas buying outright calls, you would lose all of that premium. And again, the risk zone is if the market goes up, but only goes up a little bit. And it's harder to make the argument for why that would happen as opposed to up big or down big.
And one of the things in that 1 hour boot camp that I covered was actually a really neat phenomenon that a lot of people take for granted, is that actually for a ratio call spread, that V bottom where the max risk point is can only be actually realized if you hold till expiration. It closes exactly at the short calls strike. And so what's amazing is something, and I covered in the video, is that even just a few weeks before the expiration, because there's so much time value still at the money, that often you can't reach that point of max risk until that expiration. So long as you close the ratio call spread even a couple weeks early, then your risk of loss is even actually far less than many of these risk models will demonstrate.
Now, so far, this is pretty darn easy to understand, but when we get into this vol skew chart on page 5, it requires a little bit more explanation. What's going on here? What's the blue bar all about? Tell us what this chart means.
Right. And so one of the reasons why a ratio call spread is so attractive versus a ratioed put spread is because of the vol structure of the S&P 500 options. Now, many people look at the options and they believe that the volatility index or the VIX is the best reflection of volatility, but that implied vol is not the same at every strike price. In fact, there's one very common characteristic in many, not only in the main index, but many of the stocks that have correlations to the index, is that they have a fat left tail, which is the volatility premium on put options and call options that are at lower strike prices have higher and higher volatility premium because people demand left tail risk insurance, and therefore you're paying a substantial premium in your implied vols for buying that. But what is interesting is when you go to the right side of the skew, the blue line representing where we are at the money, is that the volatility premium on call options or on options in general, as you go to higher strikes, actually contract. So while right now, let's say volatility is give or take around 16-17% at the money, when you're going, let's say 5% out of the money on the S&P 500, you're talking about implied volatilities that are under 12%, literally 3 or 4 vol points lower in many cases. And what this does is it allows you to build these ratios really well, because if you're selling a call that has a higher vol premium and you're buying these lower implied vol call options that are out of the money, you could buy more of them. And so like Tian was suggesting, you can sometimes even hit a ratio of, you could even buy 3 or 4 call options for the premium. And this really allows you to juice up that right tail risk hedge.
And just to translate that to English for anyone whose head is still spinning, the calls that you're selling in this strategy get sold at the money. And those at the money calls are at about a 17% vol. Think of that percentage of vol as a price tag on options. The options that you're selling are selling at full price. The options that you're buying are on sale because of where they're positioned out of the money. So you get the opportunity to get more leverage out of this strategy than you normally would because of the present vol skew conditions that exist in the marketplace. Okay, Patrick, that pretty much covers the theory. Let's move on slide 6 to the actual prices that are prevailing right now in the S&P market for these calls. What are you selling? What are you buying? How many can you get? How does this actually translate to a real trade?
Right. So I just arbitrarily chose the January 2020 chain. Now, obviously, some depends on your theme and your timing. You might be choosing December's, you might be choosing March's or April's or something, like, to each their own. We're going to work with the January series. And now I personally traditionally would do something like, when I'm presenting this, I would do something like selling a call option at something like 3,050 on the S&P, just above its all-time high. For instance, on the SPX, the January call option, you would receive a $40 credit, so for like $4,000. Now, I would typically turn around and go, let's say, 50 S&P points higher to 3,100, where for $23, the call option costs. And so if I bought two of those call options, it would cost me $46 or $4,600. And so I'm out $600, and I've got a 50-point spread between 3,050 to 3,100 on the S&P. But using thematically what Tian was talking about, where you're trying to get a 3 or 4 to 1 ratio, well, in this example, if you went right at the previous highs of the S&P at 3,030 and you collected, I'm just rounding, $50 for a premium you received and you credited that, well, the 3,150 strike on the S&P are $12. And so you could literally buy 4 call options for the premium you would receive for selling the one call. And then you could really build a 4 to 1 ratio. And then what you're really doing is you're kicking up your delta, you're kicking up your gamma. You're going to have a little more vega. I mean, the one setback of this strategy is you're long vega. And when the market tends to rally, you tend to have volatility contraction and the implieds go down. And so you're fighting the vol contraction in the spread, but you are long volatility in the whole trade. And it's just a really interesting way to consider putting it on.
And for anyone who was just confused by the sudden shift to speaking Greek instead of English, Patrick's options course is what you need in order to get to speaking Greek yourself. Patrick, why don't we move on now? Amir already told us what he's speaking about at the Silver and Gold Summit in San Francisco, October 27th and 28th. You're also presenting at that event. What are you talking about? And how can our listeners get 50% off signing up to attend?
Right. And so I'm going to be talking about silver and gold cycles, and particularly how to use long dated options as a way to manage through trading these big cycles. It's a presentation I've done before, and I'm really excited about doing it. And hopefully many of our listeners can come out and join us for the presentation. With that said, the Cambridge House was kind enough to extend all of our Macro Voice listeners a 50% off using just the promo code MACRO50. And so anyone that goes to the site, make sure you type in the macro 50 promo code, get 50% off of the ticket. It makes a no-brainer to go out and see Amir and Rick Rule and many others, Marin Katusa. It's going to be a great show. And I'm looking forward to meeting so many of our listeners out there.
Well, that covers the silver and gold summit, and it also covers the ratio call spread strategy, which we heard a little bit about the setup for in our feature interview today. But Patrick, for people who want the full Monty, if you will, on options, tell us a little bit about the options trading class that you offer through Big Picture Trading.
Right. We have an options master's program where we have over 22 modules that cover every aspect of options trading. But the real value is not just the modules, but it's actually the live tutorials. And so what I do on an ongoing basis is fire up a live 1 hour tutorial for the master's members. And we do real application real time in the markets, and you learn through watching the trades put on and managed effectively. And so it's a way of learning, and I offer that mentorship by being able to see the trades being implemented and managed through their entire process.
And the best place to get started in all of that is with the free 14-day complimentary access pass, which doesn't even require a credit card to get signed up. You can find that at bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, we need to leave it there in the interest of time. Once again, this episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Freelancer.com, the best place on the internet to hire freelancers for any job, big or small. Listed on the Australian Stock Exchange under symbol FLN. Patrick, our listeners already know the benefit of registering a free account at macrovoices.com is they get the benefit of our Research Roundup email, which provides links to all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week. Please tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book for Tian Yang's presentation, as well as the ratio call spread slides we discussed in that post game. There's also an article from ChartPoint about the U.S. yields edging up as Greece funds at negative rates. I can't believe that, eh, Eric? Negative rates for Greece, right? And as well, a David Rosenberg piece about getting ready for the loonie and rates to fall in Canada as the economy sputters. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions.
The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.